You'll love this guy, the Prince, Prince Nesta.
Are you serious?
Here we go.
Well, folks, welcome. I'm Dr. Prince Nesta. This brand new show called Dr. Prince Nesta Live, where we offer raw, organic, and uncensored conversations. Real court of public opinion, if you ask me. We're going to be discussing everything, thought-provoking interviews on issues affecting us, the human race. Is the only show in town where we're gonna let you, the listener, be the judge, the jury, and the executioner, right? But right now, seated right next to me is my guest who's ready to drop you the rhymes, Professor and Poet Extraordinaire Kweku Abimbola. Show us what you're made of, brother. Give us a little something.
Yes, even before I jump in, I just want to say it's an honor to be part of this podcast with the legendary Kenyan-American doctor himself, Dr. Prince Nesta.
I appreciate it.
And yeah, just to get us going, I will read the title poem for this collection. This piece, it is an ode, right? So a praise poem to the practices of fishing that are integral to where I come from. I'm born in Gambia, born on the coast, and both my mom and my dad come from coastal areas. So this piece talks about that history and heritage, but also discusses more of the insidious side, right? Where European and American fishing corporations will regularly overfish in West African coastal waters, which then threatens the livelihood of these local fishermen and fisherwomen. So here is Saltwater Demands a Psalm. Saltwater Demands a Psalm, Jamestown Beach, Accra, Ghana. The moon's gray whisks morning waves. Groundswells glide and trade this silver snakeskin for sunrise. And we're up, my crew and I. We've been up. We've wagered the winds, traced the tides, combed and poured over our nets, nursing any tangles or weathered gaps. Our boats wait ready, licked in kente hues. Names like happiness, good luck, nyamidria, and big catch are branded onto their still banked hulls, buoyed at the heels of palm trees. Listen. We've come to shore singing, clapping, humming. Saltwater demands a psalm. We owned a measure of horizon and funked with the tide chasing it during each morning catch before the barges came. Before the big barges came and scraped our reefs clean, we now vie with them for the final fish. It's a butterfish. We haven't caught any guitar fish or grouper in months. It has to be a butterfish. They've been in my village's anchor since when I was a child learning how to fish. I asked my father if the water below us was dead. He said, the water is only as dead as the bodies beneath, and alive as the bodies above. He reached down, offering a palm full of salt water. We both drink, swear to keep this balance. You see, these aren't the first ships coming to starve us, and they won't be the last. Even our last butterfish knows this. And he's merciful. He's promised we won't even have to catch him. He'll come to us grinning and prideful, and we'll scoop him into a bucket of salt water and bring him back to shore. We'll feed him and groom him, trimming his airy whiskers. We'll dress him in purple kente like an ohene. We'll make festivals in his honor, make love in his honor, and name our children thus. On the day he finally passes, we'll gather all the village families and lead them with us to sea. And with our boats, we'll blockade the barges and bury our last butterfish. No casket, no pyre, just salt water and a song. Thank you.
Wow, this is incredible. already, I mean, it's deep stuff. There's always a surface meaning and a deeper meaning. So help us understand, what is this poem about?
Oh,
because
yeah.
sometimes it depends with who actually, you know, somehow tries to interpret it. They might misinterpret it, and that's the beauty about it.
Yeah.
But listening it straight from the source itself, yeah.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And thank you also for all of the kind words. And so breaking down, I'll first start with my inspirations as a whole.
Yes.
And then go specifically into close reading this poem, right?
Yes,
so
yes.
My first inspiration, really, I think, is just Black culture. Black culture and Black history. And much of my poetry is inspired by the Black arts movement, right? From like the late 60s through the early 70s in the US, coupled also with the era of Pan-Africanism / African nationalism that was happening concurrently. Actually, probably a little bit earlier, right? We have Ghana in 57, but late 50s through the mid 70s as well, right? Like on the continent. And these ideas of Black self-determination, these ideas of Black history and Black spirituality and Black music, right? Trying to decolonize the mind, right? Those early scholars and thinkers really influenced my work, and I was able to uncover, right, this tradition by taking Black studies classes when I was undergrad, right? So I was reading people like Angela Davis. I was reading some of the work of Kwame Nkrumah. I was reading the histories of Sankara and even Che. I'm just like, oh, wow. So these guys are really conversing, right, across continents, across oceans. And once we really sit to interrogate it, the systems of white supremacy, right, they're impacting all of us. And the more we stay divided, right, the more these systems can also continue to oppress us, right? So a lot of the work of the book comes in trying to unlearn these negative sort of ramifications and these negative afterlives of colonization, but also reach towards this idea of a shared Black experience and also a global Black culture, right? So thinking about Blackness as not something that stays static, but something that's always dynamic and also a dialectic, right? A story I love to tell is talking about how James Brown and Fela Kuti, right, they were bouncing ideas off each other, right? Sonically, yeah. right? But also in real life, they sort of count the other as inspiration, right? So there's this lovely shared history that we don't always appreciate,
yeah.
right? So that's like the biggest thing that inspired me, this idea of like a global Black culture.
Mm-hmm.
And thinking more personally, right, though, thinking about what rituals do we do as communities?
Yes.
Right. So one of the biggest motifs and metaphors in this book is the idea of like dance and like music
yeah.
as a form of communication.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Thinking especially as it intersects with the histories of dance and music on the continent.
Mm-hmm.
What were we drumming and dancing for? Right. Celebrations, harvests, supplication, forms of a prayer. So I think about, okay, these indigenous practices, what if there's ways that we can still commune with these indigenous practices, even being so far removed from them, right? So I think about DJs and DJ culture as ways of keeping the diaspora together, right?
Mm-hmm.
While we might not speak the same language always, while we might not eat the same foods, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's a certain way that we can commune through movement that doesn't necessarily require, right, for us to understand what's being said or what's being sung, but we can move together.
And even proverbs, metaphors, sayings, which you actually use in your writing.
Yeah, for sure.
Right.
For sure, for
which
sure.
is incredible. One way to connect us, because there's a quote that you don't have to be born in Africa to be an African.
Oh, yes.
Right.
Oh,
and
yes.
So I can see how, for instance, your poems are cut across the experiences of people are trying to, if you're addressing African Americans, for sure, you're trying to reconnect them
yes.
to their past history.
Yes.
And the people back in the African continent. Help me understand this.
Charlie.
You are of Ghanaian,
yes.
Gambian,
uh-huh.
Sierra Leonean.
That one.
And then you're also American.
Charlie.
Break it down
exactly.
for us, because it's just so complicated.
So much cognitive dissonance.
right.
But I was born in Gambia.
Yeah.
My mom is Ghanaian, fully Ghanaian.
Mm-hmm.
But my dad's side is where it gets tricky. You know, African men. So his father is Nigerian and Sierra Leonean. And they actually moved to Sierra Leone kind of 200-ish years ago. So a lot of that history informs my work, because people don't know that there was quite a lot of intercontinental movement within West Africa, especially from the Nigerian region, especially from the Yoruba Kingdom. So my dad's people, Yoruba, this was in the late 1800s after the British had quote-unquote abolished this slave trade, which is funny because like when you learn about it in school, it seems to be out of the benevolence of the... No, they were losing money. They had just lost the Revolutionary War and the War of 1812. France and Spain are dominating the slave trade, so to undercut their competitors, they're like, oh, let's abolish the international slave trade. So what they were doing was that they were capturing these slave ships that were still operating quote-unquote illegally. So that's what happened to one of my ancestors. My great-great-great-grandfather was captured by the Portuguese en route to Brazil, captured from Nigeria. The British intercept that ship and set them free in Freetown, Sierra Leone, which was a British colony, right? So it's like a lot of those stories are underrepresented, but because of that history is why I have this patchwork of ancestry.
That's a fascinating story, you know,
that.
And it's a place that I think is actually under research, right?
Yes, yeah.
What happened along the way, especially as far as the slave trade is concerned. Mm-hmm. It's very interesting. And you mentioned a very important thing. This actually influences you.
Oh, yes.
And
yes.
So I was wondering, because I've been reading your book, that Soul Total Demands are some poems, right? And folks, you got to check this out because I love the design of the book. And I'm just urging people out there, if you're listening to this podcast right now, pick up your copy of Soul Total Demands are some poems, one of the best poetry books that I've ever read, honestly. You know, you dedicate, first of all, this book to your grandfather.
Yes.
Tell me the story behind that. I thought that was really nice of you to do.
I appreciate that. Yeah, and I dedicated it to my grandfather because he was the first storyteller that I ever really admired. So, growing up in Gambia for the first few years of my life, we were quite lucky because my dad and all his siblings kind of lived in close proximity to my grandparents. So every week I was at cousin's house, auntie's house, they would come over. It was very much like a mixed family in the sense that no one really was worried about childcare. If my parents had to travel, it was no question that we would go to my cousin's place. If they had to travel, vice versa. So as a result, we'd always have Sunday lunch together at my grandparents' place. And my grandfather, he would tell us all these stories, the folk tales of Gambian mythology, whether it's we have a folk dragon called Ninki Nyanka, we heard those stories. We heard different variations of the tortoise and the hare and all these African tricksters, Anansi, etc. And he's a very skilled orator. So just having the ability to both hear these stories, but also be invited to participate in them as well. Because one thing that we would do as kids was that whenever we sat down to tell a story, the speaker would say once upon a time, and the audience would have to respond time, time. So it's this idea of, we don't do this thing as like a one person is speaking, one person is listening. It's more of a conversation, right? And that invitation towards performance, that invitation towards story, something that can be malleable and molded, right? It influences my writing to this day. I want it to be a conversation with the reader, with the listener, right? I want it to be more open-ended to where your personality, your assumptions can both be challenged, but also can feel seen and feel heard as well. So that history behind storytelling really informs why I would dedicate my first book to my grandfather.
Incredible, especially since both of us are from Africa. I'm from Kenya personally, and oral tradition forms a key part of our culture. Mm-hmm. And you know, you mentioned that your grandpa is actually a great orator, and I can see where your oratory skills come from.
thank you, which
is incredible. I've read a couple of your poems, and your mom and your dad also play a key role as far as their influence is concerned.
Yeah, so that's a good question. I think that, because one thing that I like to separate is that the poem self is different from like the real life, in the sense that the two can be parallel, but they're not always going to intersect, which is to say that the stories that I share in the book aren't always going to be autobiographical, and kind of the mother and father figure, some of it is influenced by my own parents, but some of it is just like more of like a composite character that also involves like certain questions that I have about parenthood, like, as a whole.
Yeah.
But I would say that what influences me and my poetry through my parents is that both of my parents are also ministers of the, yes. So it's like growing up, so I was getting the oral tradition through stories, right, from my grandfather, but also I was getting a biblical tradition through, wow, through my parents.
Powerful combination.
Right? It's a deadly combination.
It's one thing that they say about children whose parents are actually religious or pastors. They're bad kids. I don't know if that's also part of it.
You're not too far off.
Yeah. You know? But it's part of the creativity, right?
Exactly. I think that's because I was always, of my siblings, I'm the eldest, and also, yeah, I'm the only boy. So I feel like it gives me a bit more license to be rebellious, mm-hmm, but of the three, I'm the most outgoing, questioning, right? Mm-hmm. So I feel like this Christian upbringing, it left when I first went to college, for example,
yeah,
and started to read more about Pan-Africanism, read more critical race theory. I'm like, okay, so we don't interrogate this on the pulpit, right? We don't question how this book was translated, who translated it to us, right? There's a certain sense of hegemony, right, that we have. It's very strict, it's very rigid, right?
Yeah.
And one of my biggest critiques, which you see in the book, is, right, it's like, why can't we have space for questions for this faith practice that wasn't always our practice, mm-hmm, right? One of the biggest tensions in the book is, like, okay, like, how do we return to this idea of, I hate the word authentic, so I'll use a pre-colonial African identity,
mm-hmm,
right? Yeah. Because so much has been lost, so much has, we Black people, we descendants, right, we also internalize a lot, right? So I'm like, that's one of the questions, right, that now I have this Christian sort of heritage that is very recent to my lineage, right? Black people have really been Christians for what, 300-400 years, right? There's thousands of years before that where we had these traditions and beliefs, etc., right, that immediately are now in opposition to this colonial era and the post-colonial era, right, where it's either you're converting to Islam, we're converting to Christianity, everything else is seen as taboo.
Yeah. Stay tuned, hold that thought right there. I'm actually honored, right, to host one of the greatest poets, right? If you've never heard of this guy, you gotta grab his book, That Salt Water Demands a Psalm Poems. That's Kweku Abimbola. Just an honor to have him in the studio right now. So stay tuned, we'll be right back.
Thank you so much.
Soulful. I'm pretty sure you might be asking yourself, who's the producer of the spoken word instrumental? That's Vince on the beat. Beautiful tune playing right here on the Dr. Prince Nest Live. And I'm bringing you the show live straight from the shores of the Atlantic Ocean. Right now, it's truly an honor to host the wordsmith himself, Kweku Abimbola, one of the finest, best poets of all time. Link up with us, my Facebook page, that's Dr. Prince Nesta. Twitter handle, that's a Dr. Prince Nesta. And you can also follow us on Instagram. Right now, Dr. Prince Nesta. Feel free to reach out to us, all right? But you have also performed in Africa.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Which countries have you performed in?
Yeah, so in Africa, I was privileged to perform in Accra, Ghana, which is my mom's hometown. So I always feel very at home there. Mm-hmm. Also in Lagos, Nigeria, yeah, which was a really fun experience for the Lagos International Poetry Festival, which was in 2023. Yeah.
And you've performed here in the United States also.
Yes.
So my question is, because your writing investigates aspects such as colonization, mm-hmm, right, a black mourning,
yeah,
a black boyhood, gender politics, mm-hmm, and spiritual consequences of climate change, because mm-hmm, I did some research before, yeah, you came in, yeah?
You can prepare.
You're right. And so I want to find out, what is your experience like? Because you're trying to connect and using Pan-Africanism, right, mm-hmm, as a springboard, mm-hmm, right? So what's your experience performing here in the United States? And what are some of the contrasts performing back in the African continent?
That I really like that question, because I think about it a lot, because even though this is my first book, like, the poems that are in this book were written from, like, years and years ago. And I feel like when I was first entering poetry, I was typically the only black person in my classes, in these spaces.
Yeah.
Right. I had two out of like my whole undergrad, I had two black poetry professors, right?
Yeah.
So like, and I feel like unfortunately that's the case in most institutions of higher education, especially in the US, right?
Yeah.
Not always going to be as diverse. So as a result, I found myself, because I'm going to write about my experience, it's a quote unquote black experience, which, you know, just because the audience isn't black, they don't know how to interrogate the work critically. So my work was met with a lot of silence usually, or superficial sort of, oh, this is nice, da, 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 da. And then some audiences, right, in those early years weren't willing to do the work of engaging the work, my work, for what it was, right? There's certain things that you could Google that could help, you know, answer some questions, but they just didn't want to do that work, right? So I think that because of that, I found myself over-explaining. And then it wasn't really until I met some other mentors who were like, hey, like, write as if you are writing to your grandfather, right? So in that vein, it's like, I'm not explaining things to you. I'm writing it directly, right? And you really have to, I think the difference, kind of going back to the question, right? The difference that I've seen is that as a black poet who wants to write about blackness, who wants to write about Africa, who wants to write about the Pan-African experience, you have to realize that you're not going to be able to reach everybody, right? There's this idea, which is also a very capitalist idea, that you have to have a wide audience, da, 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 for you to sell your book. I'm just like, no, like, for me to talk about this to a wide audience requires me to diminish the strength of the work by over-explaining.
So it's niche-based.
Exactly. And for me, it's just a, like, that level, it creates a sense of intimacy.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that when you flip it, right, we who are born on the continent, who are educated even on the continent, or who come to the US, to the UK, other metropoles, right, we've had to do the work of interrogating literature on the basis of the home country, right? We have to interrogate Shakespeare and Byron, all these people. Like, so we're, it's like we're used to being the other, right, looking at the majority, right? And you don't see white authors having to do that same level of explanation. They write about their experience, and because they are in the quote-unquote majority in some places, that's seen to be the standard experience, right? Yeah. So for me, like, I sort of flipped it on its head. I was like, this is my experience. Now I'm the one with the microphone. Mm-hmm. You can interrogate this work the same way I've had to interrogate with your work, right? You can come, you can ask questions, but don't feel like just because it's not about you that you can't also gain something from it, mm-hmm. right? I think that's, like, the beauty of poetry is that even if the poem is place specific or like site specific or from a certain culture, right? Like, there's certain universal themes, right, that can unite us, right, as humans. So for this one, I think the themes of longing are very strong here. Themes of ancestry are very strong here. Themes of reconnection and hope, right? Like, these things that are more universal to human experience, right? And then I get into the particularities of African sort of metaphor and language and idiom, right, as the vehicle to then channel these broader themes. Yeah.
Wow.
So I think the biggest difference is when I'm here,
yeah,
audiences might not be as receptive to this specifics, right?
Yeah.
Well, like when I'm back home, it's so much easier. Like, I don't have to explain anything. For example, even like introducing poems, right? Sometimes I like, if it's a white audience or an American audience, I'll introduce certain things. Hey,
yeah,
you're going to hear this word in
to give the context.
The context.
Yeah.
I love being in spaces and audiences where the context is
comes automatic.
It comes automatic, right?
I feel the same pain, quote unquote, because with my own research, sometimes I attend some conferences where mm-hmm. they only say, all right, you're going to have to, you have 15 minutes to present your research, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And so for those people who actually are based here in the United States, mm-hmm. born here, it's like the audience already understands where mm-hmm. they're coming from.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, I have to spend around half the time allocated for me to provide context of where I'm coming from.
It's wild.
Yeah. How did you end up in the United States, first of all? Because
how
that's
we get
an
here?
Interesting one. Yeah. We want to get to know you personally as well as you work.
Yeah, so my father, he fell prey to the American dream. It's funny because he worked in communications, telecommunications. So he's more a tech guy.
Oh, he's more like me.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Yeah, I feel like you two could really get along.
The religious part,
exactly.
I'm not really sure, man.
That's the trade-off, right?
Yeah.
So his boss didn't like to travel.
Yeah.
So as a result, he was always sending my dad for these conferences in like different places, UK, France, but in the US. So this is like kind of like, this is before I'm born. So this is like early to mid 1990s, he was traveling to the U.S. This is obviously pre 9/11, so even as a Gambian national, the immigration and stuff wasn't as strict, right? So he could come to the U.S. pretty freely. He brought my mom, all this stuff, and like for them, you know, Gambia was underneath a dictator for most of my life. And for most of, for about a third of the country's in, quote unquote independence.
You're talking
right?
about Jammeh.
Yeah. So it's like
the deposed dictator.
The deposed dictator, which he was deposed in 2017. Funny story, he was my dad's older sister, so my aunt, he was in her class.
Wow.
Yeah, he was in her English class in high school. And she was always saying, oh, even back then, he was a troublemaker.
That's the problem with That's Africa. Problem. We are in love with troublemaker leaders, right? We elect them thinking that maybe they might change the... But that's a topic for another day.
Right.
Go ahead.
So because of being... In a country with a dictator, Gambia did not necessarily have that many opportunities for social mobility. Mm-hmm. He's like, let's move the family to the U.S. So he was the one that spearheaded that mission. It's funny because, you know, most West Africans historically, right, were moving to the U.K. If you're colonized by Britain, you're going to Britain. If you're colonized by France, you go back to France. So America was this sort of, his parents and like our extended family didn't like America because they saw America as dangerous, right? Which is like very true, you know, compared to most places, right? Much more domestic violence here, much more gun violence here, all this stuff. So, but you know, he was determined and he came. Eventually, he went through that maze, that labyrinth of immigration, green card, H1, da da da, and eventually was able to file for us to come as well. So, yeah, I was able to come here pretty early on. I was like 6-7 years old. And then we would go back and forth sometimes. But from middle school on, I was living in the US. Yeah, so. It's been a long journey, but I don't identify with America culturally necessarily, because we were very not strict at home, but like there's certain films and TV shows and music, especially that we weren't allowed to listen to and like we're not to watch. So I still had a very outside sort of upbringing in the sense that the things my classmates watched or listened to or you know, experienced culturally, I didn't really have that. Until like high school and really college, when I had more of a chance to experience culture outside of the home. Yeah, so that's.
But you identify with America more with the passport, unless you want to hand passport over to me.
Passport is the one thing I like.
All right, Kweku, the microphone is yours. Why don't you take us through one of your creative pieces?
Yes, thank you so much, Dr. Prince Nesta. The only host I trust.
I appreciate it.
One of one. Thank you so much for having me. So this first poem that I'm going to, or sorry, the second poem that I'm going to read for us is entitled Adinkrahene. Adinkrahene is the chief of the Adinkra symbols, and Adinkra symbols are images, pictograms from the Akan tribe in Ghana. Each pictogram or each symbol, think of it like a hieroglyph, right? It represents a different proverb, a different poem, a different saying, right? So this is the chief of the symbols and it represents charisma. Black joy circles. Black joy ellipses. See black joy circling at functions, kickbacks, cookouts. See the giddy giddy eyes when the dance circle first constellates. Who will become our first son? Someone yeses the beat. We usher our first son to the eye of the dance circle. Go, go, ay, ay. She mixes guara with zanku energy. Body rolls into legwork. Slows into a jiggy bop. Ignites her shoulders with pop locks. Hits them folks, freezes. Winds a shoki shoki, then bese. Our first sun implodes and scatters this first dance circle. Hey, that one, that one. Peep black joy's plasticity. A new circle swells. Now a second sun strides to test the pull of the first. The two loop and whoop each other, mirror each other, window each other. While dancing, they remind us that the body is a prism of rhythm. That the beat entering a black body cannot leave unchanged. Our songed sons make sculptures to time. See our animate shrines, almost see our lyric full bodies. Time come, body time. Thank you.
wonderful stuff, man. It's incredible just how you're passionate about your own project and stuff.
Thank you so much.
Of the Black Joy, I've always been hearing it. Could you please break it down for listeners who are listening to this thing right now? Because when you talk about black and joy, it's kind of weird mix. But could you please help us understand what do you mean by Black Joy, first of all, and then tell us a little bit about deeper meaning as far as the poem is concerned.
So for me, Black Joy is the spaces where black people can congregate and be candid in their expression, right? Because one of the things that, especially when you're black in a non-black space, you have to police sort of your own sound level, right? It's so strange that we live in a country that black people have the police called on them for making too much noise, right? There's this this phenomenon of like Karens, right? Like, which are this term for white people, white women specifically, who will make a scene or cause a fuss when they see black people in large numbers doing things, right? And it's funny because, well, not funny, it's sad, but it's so indicative of American history when we know that this is not a modern phenomenon, right? There were bands after the Stonewall Rebellion in Georgia, I believe in 1718. That's when drumming and gathering of blacks together around music was banned because the drums were tied to rebellion. We see the same thing in Barbados and Jamaica in the early 1600s as well, right? Because whenever slaves were about to revolt, they would use drums as a means of communication, right? So as a result of that, drumming was illegal, right? So this idea of black noise for the colonist, for the enslaver, was significant of revolution, revolt, and danger, right? That same sort of fear, right, unfortunately still persists today. So in an attempt to reclaim these spaces that have been coded as dangerous, coded as quote-unquote uncivilized or ratchet or hood, right? Black Joy for me is a reclamation of a safe black space for self-expression, right? And I think Toni Morrison, who's one of my favorite writers and someone who really inspires both my work but also how I view the world, right? One of my favorite quotes from her is that racism is a distraction, right? We who live in these spaces, right, where we have to police ourselves, that's distracting us from the actual joy of living, right? If I have to think about, oh, I must monitor my volume, my tone, so I'm not perceived as a threat, it's anxiety, it's stress, it's distracting me from just living regular life, right? So in the same way, right, we have these terms like code switching, which I'm sure we both do all the time, being one of like five black professors in like a majority white institution. Like, we have to present ourselves in a certain way that is palatable, right, to this white gaze.
There's a little performativity.
Exactly. Yeah. So for me, Black Joy is strip away the performance, strip away the white gaze, be yourself, be loud, be free. And that in itself is a form of resistance, right? Because we're saying, hey, white world, whatever gaze is looking at me, y'all don't define how I'm going to act. I get to define that, you know? So yeah, that's my sort of take on Black Joy. Many other scholars, especially from the book Black Futures, edited by Jenna Wortham, right? They have a whole section on Black Joy that talks about how in popular culture, blackness is usually associated with pain, struggle, misery, right? We have the blues tradition. We have these slave narratives, which like art, historically accurate, right? But it paints a picture that always ties blackness to suffering and always ties joy with the sense of overcoming, right? It's a very binary, very transactional, very reductive view of blackness. We are complex individuals, right, who don't just dance because we're so oppressed, you know? Like, this is like not our one outlet to express ourselves. Like, no, we dance because we have joy, right? We experience joy because we're human beings capable of experiencing joy. It's not because of all these things that are not placed upon us, right? So I think that is also, right, a reclamation of this kind of black expression through media as well, right? Like, our joy is not the result of, you know, some long history of oppression, right? We were joyful before y'all came, you know, and we're going to continue joyful now, and we're damn sure going to be joyful in the future.
In fact, actually, one of the things I always tell my friends here in America is that back in Africa, people make lesser money, but they're happier. here in America, people make more money, but they're more depressed, right? And so it's really interesting to see. And also, I'm trying to connect it to scholars such as Foucault, who talks about the concept of the panopticon, where you kind of somehow always have to police yourself, right? But, you know, I'm looking at Instagram, for instance, or Facebook or social media, where black people have to somehow know what they write, what they write about, how, you know, they behave. Because they always have this feeling that they're being watched somehow.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of interesting to also connect it with the black joy and performativity and all this concept. But back to your own poem.
Yes.
Is it like your experiences, or is it personal experiences that influence you to write?
Definitely. Yeah, it's definitely a mix. I think that how I describe my poetry is it's selective biography or selective autobiography. Sometimes we heighten things, sometimes we take things away, but one thing that is true to me is that I love to dance. So the dance poems that I write in this collection are drawn from my, most of me personally dancing, but also just like traveling in different spaces in the diaspora and watching people in, again, these candid moments, right? Whether it's like in a club or at a cookout or just in someone's apartment, right? Just having the space to freely be themselves, right? That's really what it inspired the dance poems that are in this collection as well. And I also really appreciate what you said about like social media too, right? Because like that is also a space where we get this heightened sense, especially because like much of this book was written during the pandemic. And one of the sad things about that period was that there was this huge upsurge in violence, right? Especially like, and there was much more police brutality footage that was being shown to us on social media.
It was a terrible season.
It was a really bad season. And it's like, shout out to us for calling out the injustices, but also there's a certain toll that it takes on your mental health to see these images of black people always being brutalized, always in this position of being powerless, like in an unfortunate sense. So I think Black Joy also wants us to like, hey, in spite of this, right, we can use joy as a kind of resistance because it shows more of our humanity than these other images, right, that are being sort of flooding social media as well.
What is your take on, you know, the pushback on diversity, equity, and inclusion aspects? Because then that also ties in perfectly well. Because if it's opportunities, I also affect joy, right? Somehow.
Yeah.
Because,
it's true.
Fun and joy is all connected to the economy somehow. Yeah. But we are seeing an attack, especially from the right, in regards to some of these initiatives. Your take?
Oh, yeah. For me, it's just like it's very telling. Because obviously we're both professors in a Florida-based institution, right?
Yeah.
And when you look at American history, especially in the American South, there have been calculated efforts to glorify and to lionize the attempts of the Confederates, right? There have been, whether it's through textbooks, the Daughters of the Confederacy being a group that donated heavily to certain political campaigns and who were on school boards, right? They were writing textbooks, whether it's through the statues that were being built, right? So what I see now with these attacks on diversity, equity, and inclusion is that it's an incomplete view of history, right? It wants us to arrive at a post-racial society without doing the work of internal investigation and also without changing the structures that led us to be in the space in the first place. How I see is that like racism in America is like a wound, right? And when you are a child, you injure yourself. The first thing that you do, mom or dad or whoever, right? You have to put the alcohol in it. It hurts. You don't want to put the alcohol on the wound. You'll be screaming, you'll be crying, but that's necessary to heal the wound. What I see with these efforts is that, hey, they see that the wound is there. They don't want to put the alcohol. Right, they don't want to deal with the uncomfortable conversations of white privilege. They don't want to deal with those conversations. So to do that, to say, hey, this problem doesn't exist anymore. But when you look at the statistics, right, it's very apparent that in hiring, in student body populations, right, in all these positions of power, right, there's a very strong skew. And I'll use this kind of funny anecdote, right? So I was on a plane recently and I was watching the Barbie movie. Right. And one of the scenes in the Barbie movie was that Ken, who is the male counterpart to Barbie, he goes to this office building and he finds a white man in a suit. And he's like, hey, I want to have a job because I'm a white man. And then he was like, oh, it must be harder for us now given all these, you know, diversity, da da. And then the man in the suit was like, actually, no, it's like, we're still in power. We're just better at hiding it. So I think that even though that's like a moment of humor in a blockbuster Hollywood movie, right? How radical can it really be? I think it's true to the experience right now, is that like these people, right, are still fighting to hold power, and they're trying to hide the fact that they hold all this power. And I feel like that's like what these attacks on DEI are, is that, hey, we see that these Negroes, these colored folks, they haven't getting a little too much power, calling us out a little bit too much, right? Yeah. It's like, y'all had your cake, y'all had Obama, right? Obama is president, racism is over. We don't need these offices anymore. Like, you know, it's like this idea that there's some finite finish line that we have to cross, and we've crossed it.
Yeah.
So work is done.
And that's interesting because, you know, I have to indulge me here. I've been in this country for 7 years now.
Yeah.
My experiences are quite different, although we are both Africans, but my experiences in the U.S. are quite different, right? And so I came from Africa, a place where, yes, there is racism, kind of, but very limited, and most of the time is mostly from the Asians, right? And their issues with, let's say, Africans, right? And a minimal level. At the same time, Arabs also. And in some countries such as South Africa, Kenya, very minimally, all right? Maybe one or two cases or some cases where, but we're still affected. We've gone through aspects such as colonialism. There's also issues. Neocolonialism still affects us big time, right? And so I didn't come from a highly charged, racialized environment, the way, for instance, he experiences in the United States. And I had to find myself, as soon as I arrived here, right? And some of these aspects, because as soon as you arrive here, you are considered black, right? And you are placed into this bandwagon, based off of the history of the culture. But based off of my experiences, and I know part of your target audience as far as your poetry is concerned is also folks like me back in the African continent, right? And you also target African diaspora. And so based on that, I guess, example that I've given you, how do you then navigate in terms of, since you also mentioned that poetry is a niche audience space and you can't claim that you're targeting every African diaspora, right? It also has to deal with class somehow. And so how do you then navigate some of these aspects or some of these issues?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I think that coming from a, I think how I root it is that blackness is malleable. So when I'm talking about a black identity or black culture, one of the things that I make sure to do is to like be as specific as possible so that I don't claim someone else's experience, right? Because similarly, right, like I didn't consider myself black until I came to this country, right? Like people back home don't use that to describe ourselves, right? At least in Gambia, right? You don't identify by race, you identify by tribe, right? Which also has its own sort of like tribalism, classist, sometimes even colorist ramifications. But you know, like that for us, I feel like everywhere you go, there is a hierarchy, right? So for us in America, that hierarchy is race, right? For other people back home, that hierarchy is going to be class, right? For other people, it might even be, I don't know, like clan or like your family name, da da da, right? So I think I navigate these differences by being specific and by also noting that I'm not speaking for everyone. I'm speaking from a very specific voice and a very niche experience, right? So if you can relate to it, that's great. And I think that what poetry does, that even like music tries to do, right? Even if you don't understand the language, I want the language to be inviting enough for you to say, okay, even if I don't get the meaning, it sounds good. You know, like there's certain songs that you hear even from our beloved Afrobeats artist, you're like, what the hell is he saying? I don't know, but shit, it sounds good. You know, like, I can dance to it, you know.
I was alone.
Right? I'm like, that's not any language, right?
Yeah.
But that's what I think what poetry does, right? You want to invite the reader enough with this with language, right? Say, okay, whether it's a simile or a rhyme scheme, metaphor, da da da, to where they feel, right, even without knowing. And I think that's what is kind of goes back to, right, just trying to decolonize how we even experience. Like, literature here, I think, is very, like, knowledge-based, right? The whole, I think, therefore I am. But for me, it's like, okay, like let's, like, turn on his head. Like, let's go back to Audre Lorde, right? I feel, therefore I am, right? How can my poetry move you to this place of feeling first before you then bring in thought, right? Like, we don't always have to be so analytical from the jump, right? Let's talk about and let's try to ease into this place of feeling, of emotion through the musicality of the language, and then sort of reverse engineer it to get to a place of meaning.
Powerful stuff. Hold on that thought right there, folks. We're going to be coming back soon. And Kwek will actually be taking us through his journey, right? He's a professor. He was a visiting professor at the University of Tampa. Now he's going to be moving on to other things. We also have a lot to catch up on, especially who are some of the poets who actually influence his work and other things. So stay tuned, folks. We'll be right back in a jiffy. Folks, we are back, right? And I'm joined by an award-winning poet who has experienced plenty of experiences as far as writing aspects in relations to black mourning, black boyhood, colonization. Some of the aspects that he investigates includes gender politics and the spiritual consequences of climate change in West Africa, right? We also talked about the Black Joy, which is a place, a topic that I always find so fascinating. A good friend of mine, Kweku Abimbola, whose book Soul Total Demands Sasam Poems is actually a must read for you, all right? So I'm going to read that again. Soul Total Demands Sasam Poems. I like the cover itself, actually.
Thank you so
much. It has a deeper meaning, which you might be touching on. But I want to come back to you, Kwek. Welcome once again.
Thank you again.
Talk to me a little bit about what you're doing to inspire the next generation. It's really important because a lot of people are listening to this right now. Mm-hmm. They want themselves, they want to be like you. They want their sons and daughters to be like you.
Hey, Shresha. Right? Word, I really appreciate that. And before moving to Tampa, to Florida, to be a visiting professor, I worked for a literary nonprofit, Inside Out. So that allowed me to work with middle, elementary, and high school students and teach them creative writing. And I did that for about 2.5 years when I was still in Detroit. And that was one of the most fulfilling... It was difficult. It was challenging, right? But it was one of the most fulfilling things I did because... This was in Detroit public school system. So the majority of my students are black students, right? I had a few Senegalese students, right? So it was a lot of fun to see their excitement for language, right? And in a school system, especially like in America, I feel like every school system that you go to, right? It's really about getting the right answer. It's very rigid, right? At early ages, they're stressed with tests and all this stuff. I'm like, so creative writing for them was kind of an escape, and I wanted it to be a structured escape in the sense that you can be wild, you can be free, you can express your ideas, but also here are some tips and tricks and techniques to make what you're saying even more powerful, right? How can you say it in a way that can reach even more people? How can you say it, or how can you try a new way of conveying the same idea? So that was the thing that I think inspired me the most, right? Thinking about my role as a poet, is it just to entertain, but also to educate, right? Because what I'm doing is giving students tools towards self-revelation, right? Because poetry can be a tool for understanding self, giving students tools towards self-expression. And also one of the things that we did a lot of, right, was performance, right? So teaching how do we also perform our work, right? What are some tips for public speaking, memorizing your lines, da da da. So I thought, Inside Out, if you're ever in Detroit, you're lucky to attend one of the workshops or attend one of their events. Amazing, amazing organization. So that's like what I did to inspire, and then what I want to encourage young poets and young writers to do is to be your first yes, right? I think that in our world today, where economy is not it, you know, everybody's hustling. Everybody's hustling, and I feel like the creative arts are not always seen as the most lucrative path, right? Which doesn't say that you become an artist to make money, but you have to find a way to support yourself, obviously. So because it's not so popular, like no one has to, there's not some big campaign to get people to be poets, right? Because it's not seen as being popular, right? You have people who want to be doctors, engineers, especially being African, right? Hey, you have doctor, lawyer, engineer. I chose none of those paths, right? So I think that if you're really passionate about it, you have to be your first yes. You have to be the first person to believe in yourself. That's the first thing I'll say. Secondly, find a community that supports you. Mm-hmm. Right? For me, that was Inside Out. For me, that was my cohort members in my MFA program, right? Finding people who are like-minded and who value what you do. Mm-hmm. Right? And third, I would say that write what excites you, but also write what you're afraid to write. Right? Pay attention to the things that you think you can't say. Pay attention to whatever haunts you, right? Pay attention to all these things that you obsess over. And don't be afraid to write them, right? Like Nina Simone says, right? Like, what is freedom to me? Freedom is no fear. And I feel like as Black writers, there's so many things that we have been taught to fear. There's so many things that we have been taught not to say, right? But I encourage younger writers to embrace those things, right? It's not everything that I have to publish right away, but really pay attention to what things you might be afraid to write and start from there.
You're too wise. I mean, it's exciting. It's just so fantastic to listen to you drop all these vibes, good stuff. But you know, it's not always that rosy, right?
Exactly.
Sometimes, and I'm a creative artist myself, somehow worked in radio for years, right? Also on my own internet radio station, NNN Radio. I'm also doing podcasts now. I'm trying to keep up with the trends. But sometimes, especially for a poet, you know, you're addressing a crowd that just seems, I don't know if you've had that experience.
Whoa, all the
but
time.
Sometimes,
yeah.
You know, you're addressing a crowd, you don't even know if they're still there, if you're somehow alone on stage. And what I'm trying to say is that how do you deal in a situation, and maybe there's some poets listening to you right now who have also encountered the same situation, so they might encounter the same situations in the near future. How do you deal with a situation where you find yourself performing to a dead crowd?
I've been there before.
Yeah.
Like one thing that like we touched on a little bit earlier, but not quite, is that when you're in, for example, when you're in the U.S. and you are even a Black poet, in most cities that you go to, the audience that is coming to the bookstore, the audience that's coming to your poetry reading at a university, it's gonna be middle-aged white women, right? I don't know if that's just for poetry, if that's for literature as a whole, right? Many audiences are going to be whiter unless you're specifically in a Black space, right? Which was shocking to me when I first published, because I was living in Detroit at like when this book came out. Detroit is the Blackest city in the US, so I was very used to being in front of Black audiences, right? So in those situations, no real issues. There's sometimes where I'm invited to this institution or that private audience is like white people in their 60s. So once I, thankfully the poems in this book are pretty wide in their range. Once I know this audience isn't my target audience, I pick the poems that are not going to go over their heads. And then, like, you also have to realize that there's always so much that you can do. I think we put too much pressure on ourselves, right? And there's one story that from my Bible school days, right? Sunday school days, sorry, right? There's this parable where Jesus went back to his hometown, but even the people in his hometown didn't receive what he had to say.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just like, you know what? If this whole savior had like if he had a tough crowd, it's okay if I have a tough crowd here and there, you know.
What's that saying? A what is never recognized at their home, or
exactly. A prophet is never
prophet.
On it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'm like, you know what, Charlie, is okay, you know. Mm-hmm. And like for me, because you also have to be cognizant of, if you're a young poet who's trying to make your way, be very intentional with who your audience is, because I'll perform the same poem, bro, in the same poem, the exact same way.
Yeah.
One audience is losing their minds. Yeah. Same poem that I performed in Accra, come to the U.S., come to some predominantly white institution, perform it, everybody's quiet. You know, so it's just like, so when you have that different audience, you know that, okay, it's not me. You know,
maybe cultural based.
It's called, also, I think one difference is that a Black crowd is more used to this call and response. You know, especially if
more
they come
conversationalist.
Exactly, right.
Yeah.
Especially if they come from like a religious tradition, right?
Yeah.
Christianity, right?
Yeah.
Like preachers are like that.
Yeah.
I found that white crowds have much more decorum. Like they'll just clap at the end. You know, like they won't shout or do anything. Which like, but I think because that was my upbringing, right, in that like sort of Black religious space, like that's what I like, you know. So sometimes I've seen poets who like tell the audience, they're like, hey guys, like, let's, it's funny, but it can save you in a performance. Before they start, they say, hey, my name is XYZ. They talk about themselves and like, okay, let's practice snapping. So they have the audience snap. And then like, let's practice clapping. And then send a round of applause. And then say, give me a good ooh. And then the audience does it. So like they prime the audience, say, hey, it's okay for you to do this while I'm performing.
Oh.
That's a tip that I learned from the performance artists in Detroit, that if I'm really struggling, I just be, hey, audience, chale, it's okay for you to make some noise. You know what I'm saying? Just like, right. I do it jokingly, but also it's inviting them if they're an audience that isn't used to interjecting while someone is also performing. But yeah, it can be very discouraging.
It can be very discouraging, yet you're on award-winning, multiple award-winning. What are some of these awards that you've actually scooped? It just goes on to show how hardworking you are, and you know the extra effort that you put, such that to get to an extent where you're being recognized, it just means that you're so great. Yeah. So, what are some of these awards that you've won?
Yeah, thank you so much again. So the first one that made the book possible was the Academy of American Poets first book prize. So that one, I won that in 2022, and that prize was for unpublished poets. So they took my manuscript and then they published it, right? So I had to work with editor, but that prize allowed me to have my book published. And then the year the book was published, 2023, I won the American Booksellers Association. They had a first book award for writers under a certain age. So I won that award. And then there's the same organization, the ABA, American Booksellers Association, had indies, so like bookstores who are like not as big. They can choose a poet, a fiction writer, right, as their book to promote for that year. So that one was 2023 as well. 2024, I won the Nasrat Yassini Poetry Prize, which was sponsored through the University of New Hampshire. And then the most recent award, which is one that I was very surprised by, I won a Florida Book Award. So that one is given to a outstanding work of literature that's published by someone living in Florida or that talks about subject matter that's in Florida. And for that one, there's a poem in the book that talks about Trayvon Martin, who's from Florida, but also I was living in Florida at the time, so I was considered for this award. So
yeah,
it was funny because I had to send a copy of the book to the governor's mansion, so I had wrote a little note in there for the governor.
What note did you write to the governor? Is that Ron DeSantis?
Yes, I said,
my goodness,
because they said, oh, sign one to the state of Florida. I said, dear state of Florida, poems don't sink so easily, and I signed my name. So that was sort of my own way of talking without saying.
Do you think he read it? Do you think?
I don't think he read it. I'd be like, he doesn't have time to read much, or read black poetry for that matter. Yeah. But I think it's just sort of, it was heartening for me that people are still championing black voices in the state where they're firing black professors and defunding critical race theory scholars and defunding women and gender like there's so much anti-intellectualism happening in the state. So I was really happy that the Florida Book Awards Association, they're still one of the last sort of state level groups that are trying to say, hey, despite what's happening, we still value these diverse voices.
It's terrible what's going on. Do you think, a lot of professors, especially educators, have been affected by these political shenanigans going on. But has it affected you as a poet also, a creative artist? Or you have to watch your back in terms of spaces where you perform?
Thankfully, I haven't encountered it that much in Florida, because I think I've been very selective in going to majority black or Latinx spaces, right? So whether it's like a open mic or even
more
for
progressive
spaces. So I feel like in those spaces you don't feel like you're in Florida, you feel like you're just like in a different world. But I feel it has affected a lot of colleagues that I know who've left the state, right, to pursue other job opportunities in more progressive spaces, right? And you can't fault them for that. It's difficult because now we have these big holes that who knows when they'll be filled. One thing that is also heartening is that the black church, for all of its unique troubles and all of its unique problems, right, has taken upon itself in Florida, right, many black churches, have started teaching Black history on Saturdays. Wow. Right? So instead of having Sunday school, they had to open it up to the community and invite scholars to then give like a public lecture. Mm. Right? I'm like, this is, you know, it shows Black resilience, you know, because we've never in this country, it's never been like perfect. With every advancement, there is always, you know, one step forward, two steps back, right?
Yeah.
So this is the moment where even though we have this state level ban, right, or these bans on books, right, you still have people who are passionate about, hey, we know what our power is and how we can use that power. And if the kids can't learn it in school, we'll teach it to them in the pulpit, right? Which I think is more churches, I would hope, would start to do that as well.
Well, I know we've talked, but, you know, forgive me because I've got like two or three last questions to
ask. Do your thing, man. I'm excited.
Yeah. Dead or alive, what's some of the points that you look up to?
I love this question because my list changes so often.
Yeah.
Let's see. Living poets, Dinesh Smith is one of my biggest inspirations. They were one of the people who was so gracious to blurb the book and one of the first readers of the collection. Another poet that I really admire, Asia Monet. She is a Black surrealist blues poet. So she performs her work with like a blues and jazz band. And for me as a performer, I want to get to that level to where I can take my work from the page and then transform it through performance, right? Because she does both. Obviously, she writes books, but also she performs with a band, which I think is really dope. For me, I'd love to do it with like an Afrobeat or like a palm wine or like a high life kind
of thing. You're thinking
groove.
About palm wine.
You see? it's 5 o'clock somewhere.
Yeah, I need to be in Ghana right
now. You see now.
Yeah.
So Dinesh, Asia. As well as Nally Diaz, I think her collection, Postcolonial Love Poem, really inspired how I viewed love poetry, right? Because what she does is that she roots kind of similar to June Jordan, right? She talks about the individual desire, but all of the ramifications and layers, right? It's like, yes, I'm someone who has desire, but also I'm someone who identifies, you know, as X, Y, and Z identity that are all being attacked by the state, right? So I thought like, that ability to so tactfully render the complexities of human experience, especially human desire, in that collection really informed my work. So those are my top three living, or not top three, but people who definitely inspired my work, living. Dead Poets, the first poet that I think I ever read and most Black people read, Langston Hughes. So he's a big one. I was honored to, I performed in his house in New York because it's like, it's sad because someone else has taken over it, but there used to be a Langston Hughes Foundation to where they would have an open mic. So when I was still a young teenage poet, I went to New York with some friends and was able to go to Langston Hughes' house and perform there. And it's so beautiful to see how they kept the house. And he was a poet who, you know, similar to like what we discussed earlier, was very intentional about also charting the path for the younger generation. So he wrote kids' books. He also helped to edit younger poets' work, etc. So very, 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 he discovered poets like Lucille Clifton, who's another giant in Black American poetry. And a good segue, because she's also one of my biggest influences as well. Lucille Clifton, who was born in upstate New York, grew up both in New York, but also in the American South. And yeah, the way that she uses Black language and the simplicity of Black idiom. Well, I wouldn't say simplicity. She uses colloquial language and reveals its potency, mm-hmm. right? There's certain sayings that are sort of innate to a Black household that we don't realize how poetic they really are.
Mm-hmm.
And Lucille was someone who takes, right, this capital P poetry, this Shakespearean and these heroic couple, da, 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 and she's like, okay, like, that's cool. But here is it. Here is Black poetry through a lens of Black language, through another lens of a certain accessible colloquial language, but also I'm going to leave surprise, and I'm going to leave these really, really tasty and wise lines for you as well. A final poet that I'll name is Melvin Dixon, one of my favorite poetry professors told me to buy the Oxford Anthology of African American Poetry. Mm-hmm. I bought it when I was like 19. It was very cheap, wow. Like probably like $6. And that thing became my Bible. The poet, Melvin Dixon, he was a black gay poet writing in the 90s. Unfortunately, fell prey to AIDS, right? So we lost him very early. But he's a black poet who traveled to Senegal. And he wrote about visiting the Senegalese slave castles, right, that had been built by the French. And seeing how he's able to sort of shift scenes between stanzas, right, and control the pace of the poem, right, that was really inspiring to me. Also, the themes he was writing about identity and loss and longing and history, right, those all really were attractive to me at the time because I was, again, teenage poet trying to reconcile my African identity with this American space, and he was able to sort of traverse those poles, right, very well.
And there are points that you can't stand there, Juan.
Trying to get me in trouble.
yeah, you know, honestly, because, you know, the thing about these podcasts is that you got to be honest,
you
gotta
honestly.
Be honest.
Oh, man.
You can't stand there, Juan. This garbage, or maybe you never want to listen to this stuff anymore.
Oh, God. I think that there's very, I mean, I think because I'm picky with what I read.
Come on, don't be politically correct. Shoot straight.
I'm trying to think. I think poets that I don't like Ezra Pound very much. I don't like he's not a poet, but he wrote fiction. He wrote Heart of Darkness. I don't like Joseph Conrad at all. It was a poet that I don't like that I'll go on the record as saying, I don't like what Sylvia Plath was able to get away with. So Sylvia Plath is a very strong poet, right? Confessional poet writing in the like 60s, 70s. I forget exactly when she died, but she was one of the feminist, right? One of the proto-feminist poets who's writing about, right?
Yeah.
These confessionals about like mental health and family and gender, right? Very powerful stuff. But then she has a poem, right? Where she compares herself to black people, except she uses the word nigger in that poem. And I'm like, you can't do that. You know what I'm saying? It's very offensive to A, try to compare your own oppression to a different race, right? And then to then use that euphemism to describe yourself.
Yeah. Was it like culturally acceptable at that particular time when they were writing?
Yeah.
Because if you did it right now, let's say the last 30 years or something, then it'd been hot soup. But at some point, you know, these are some of the, because some of these labels, I think they have somehow metamorphosized from Negro to African-American to black to, you know, and they keep on changing. So
I definitely take that point, but I think it was when she wrote it, it was at a time when the N-word was now being seen as being offensive.
I see.
Because now, like, black people at that time preferred to be called Negro or colored, but, like, N-word was still offensive, but she still uses it.
I see.
Yeah, which to me, like, that always put a bitter taste in my mouth. I'm like, which isn't to say that other poets haven't done equally harmful things.
Yeah.
But that conversation, I don't think, is always
sort of
had.
Waters down.
Yeah, and I think that that's also like my. It's an endless debate with art, right? Like, sure, she was saying that to provoke, but what is the harm that provocation caused? Because it's not harming you, white woman, for saying that, right?
Yeah.
It's harming other people who like now feel some type of way about your work because. Yeah. You're trying to cheapen their experience by comparing yourself to it, you know, so.
Yeah. Oh, wow. That was a tough one. I'm really sorry for putting you on this spot.
No, you're good, you're good.
Absolutely. And, you know, I want to talk a little bit about your future. One of the disappointments, right, reading your book, because, you know, I've gone through, I don't say that I've gone through all of it, but I was going through it just before you came into the studio. That's the book, Saltwater,
Saltwater,
how Americans say, that's Kwaku Abi Bimbola's book, Soul to Aura Demands Some Poems. Mm-hmm. All right, you gotta check it out, folks. You can find it on Amazon, right? Mm-hmm. Or any other stores out there. So check it out and get yourself a copy. Fantastic poetry in there. One of the disappointments about your book, not really disappointment because I know this is also tied to your feature somehow. Mm-hmm. I'm from East Africa. Mm-hmm. I didn't even see one word in Swahili. Right? So tell me about that, because you're a little bit biased. You focus more on West Africa.
It's true.
And so, you know, Africa is a big continent. South Africa, Southern Africa, Eastern Africa, Northern Africa. What are you doing in terms of your future? Tell us a little bit about your next projects and how you think you're going to incorporate all these aspects.
Yeah, that's really funny, but also very, like, very true, right? Mm-hmm. It's like I'm writing from a very West African biased point of view. You know, I think that that bias also comes from, like, what I'm trying to do in the book historically, thinking about, okay, which populations were the most likely to come through this Middle Passage? And it was not as much from East Africa. But I'm waiting for you to teach me Swahili so I can then add it to the next book, you
see?
Anytime. As far as future projects, I'm working on a collection of poems entitled Chant. And those poems reimagine my great-great-grandfather's story, right, being captured and being set free. But it does it in this way that also incorporates Brazil, right? So basically, the collection focuses on two individuals, a husband and a wife, who are separated, right? The husband is a drummer. The wife is a dancer. So when the husband is taken from Nigeria to Brazil, this is, again, during the period of enslavement, he's able to escape and join a Maroon community, or a Quilombo, right, of other previously enslaved Africans who are now living free.
Yeah.
And what he wants to do is, he says, hey, I've been enslaved, I've been free, how can I recreate the cultural elements of my hometown? And he tries to do that through drumming. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So he tries and fails. And all this is an attempt to keep the history of his people, of his name, but also of his lover, his wife, alive. Right. Long story short, actually, I won't reveal much more other than the fact that there's this ritual that he tries to do to conjure the essence or the spirit of this lover. And that ritual fails. And there's some ramifications that he now has to deal with. Because he failed in this ritual. So that's like one of the collections that I'm working on. The next book that I'm working on, or the second book, third, whatever, is entitled Kachikali. That's a story of a young boy whose mother is taken by Jammeh's government, which was sadly pretty common during that time, because the president thought he could cure AIDS, so he would take people randomly to perform these experiments. So his mother is one of those unfortunate people who was taken. But he realizes that his mother was actually one of the early organizers in the resistance against the dictator. Mm. And in trying to find out more about her legacy, he becomes implicated. So the novel is really about his growth and whether or not he's willing to take up the mantle of what his mother started, right? By resisting the dictator, trying to organize for free and fair elections as well. So those are the two things I have on the burner. Trying to knock out some pages during the summer that I have some free time.
You're moving on to greener pastures. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, moving out west. So I'll be a professor of English and poetry at Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles. So if you're in LA, that's my soon to be new stomping grounds. Excited to explore, you know, life and art and nature out there, and just, yeah, see what the West Coast has to offer.
Hey, man. I hope you'll continue doing poetry.
Oh, yes.
Because you might get there and get blinded by all this stardom. And, you know, I've been
Hollywood.
Told there a lot of, it's like Sodom and Gomorrah down there. I don't know if that's true, but
you got to come visit.
I'm honestly kind of scared that you might lose track a little bit.
<so. Bush.
laughs> Incredible. Well, one last question, and then we're going to go on to, you're going to read for us one of your points, all right? African continent is bleeding right now, right? Mm-hmm. We look at the situation, poor leadership sometimes. Mm-hmm. We have puppet governments. Mm-hmm. We have people who've lost hope.
Mm-hmm.
right? Based off of different reasons. There might be corruption. Some of them are still reeling from colonization. Neo-colonialism is also a big deal. We are still affected somehow with imperialistic tendencies. At the same time, we also put their leaders who sometimes they need for themselves. What's your message for the youths and generally for the people in the African continent? Your beloved continent is crying out for you. So what would you like to tell them?
Pressure. But I think that what I'll say is that I'll turn to a proverb. A proverb says, when you pray, move your feet. And I think that too often our people back home have been in many ways influenced by religion, influenced by these belief systems that don't always require action, especially coming from a Christian tradition where for you to rebel against the British is in a way to rebel against Christianity, right? So in that sense, I want us to have faith, but also to take action. And for me, I think it's very telling that the leaders that were assassinated, right, there's a reason they were killed. I encourage folks to really read the books written by Nkrumah, to read the histories of Sankara and Lumumba, and to understand that they were assassinated because they were trying to unite Blacks on the continent, Blacks in the diaspora. The struggles that we face in Africa are not unique to Africa, right? Black people in Brazil and Venezuela and Cuba, across the global south, are dealing with similar issues. So for us, it's not enough for us to focus only on this national level. I think that the power and the revolution and the liberation will come when we look at our shared struggles across the diaspora, right? So again, that's again looking towards our brothers and sisters to see how we can help each other, but also again, as we pray, move our feet.
Powerful.
Thank you.
Powerful indeed. How would you like to be remembered?
Ooh, that's a good question. I think that how I would like to be remembered.
No, but you're gonna die the next day.
Right. I would like to be remembered as someone who didn't just create. I think that creativity is important. I think that it's a big part of my identity, but I want to be remembered as someone who made space for others and who was unafraid of speaking their truth. Yeah, I feel like if nothing else matters, if people remember me, hey, he made opportunities for other people. If you remember me, hey, he was there for us, and also he spoke his truth without fear, I'll be happy with that. Yeah, I'll be very happy with that. And if you remember me for bringing joy, I'll be happy with that too. Our names are days. Each syllable holds hours. Each letter, minutes, moments. Time is a child. A black child playing tag with their shadow in a field of juniper. Above this chase, the sun sips indigo.
That's so short and sweet, but you know, hey folks, one more time, you gotta buy the book, right, to catch the whole deal. As that Saltwater Demands Some Poems by Kwaku Abimbola. Truly honored to have you in studio right now. And, you know, you've graced the occasion, actually, the first episode ever.
Thank you so much.
2 hours of your time, honestly, truly humbled. We wish you all the best in your future endeavors. And hopefully you're going to join us one of these fine days on this podcast, right? And so there are a lot of people who I'm sure would like to link up with you. How can they find you?
Oh, yes. Well, yeah. Thank you so much again for having me. I really appreciate how you sat with the work and interrogated it, and you saw it in a light that made me feel seen. So thank you so much for your questions and for just your candor with the whole interview process as well.
Appreciate it.
And to connect with me on social media, on my Instagram and Twitter, you can find me on Instagram at KWXKU_. Twitter is at KWXKUU, because the other one was taken. I don't know who took that handle. And then you guys will find me if you want to buy the book or just connect with me on my website, KwekuAbimbola.com. So KWKUABIMBOLA.com. takes you to my webpage. You can read more poems that I have. You can order the book directly from the webpage as well. And yeah, you can find this book at local bookstores. You can find it online, Amazon, etc., etc. But don't buy from Amazon. Bezos has too much money. Go support your local independent bookstore. They should have that in stock. So, yes.
You cannot make this stuff up. There's only one place to catch up such content, and that's right here. So from me, Dr. Prince Nesta, I'm going to say take care of yourself, do good, and be good, all right? Until we meet again. Any last words for your fans, the people listening?
I'm so grateful for this opportunity.
Yeah.
I hope that you all can, again, just find moments to enjoy and to take a breath and to be with those that you love. And to be with the things that you love. Yeah, wishing you all peace, joy, prosperity, and Black liberation.
Thank you.